This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the towns of Gardner, Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Petersham, Templeton, Westminster, and Winchingdon. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashburnham, Petersham, and Winchingdon. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Gardner News, covering the week of 7/23 through 7/29. This is Alexandra Zapantis. Haunted Items Exhibit, Coming to S.K. Pierce Mansion. This is a staff report for the Gardner News. A new exhibit featuring claimed haunted items is coming to the S.K. Pierce Mansion in Gardner. Paranormal researchers Satori Hawes and Cody Despines will display approximately 75 to 100 claimed haunted items, along with historical artifacts in the mansion's basement, according to a community announcement. The exhibit will be open from July 26th through August 9th. Hawes and Despines, known for their appearances on Ghost Hunters and Ghost Nation, note that the stories behind these objects come directly from case files and donors around the world. Guests will have the opportunity to tour the exhibit, investigate the mansion, and even stay overnight with the items if they choose, according to the announcement. A unique opportunity for paranormal enthusiasts. The S.K. Pierce Mansion is known for its paranormal activity, making it a fitting location for the exhibit. It is considered one of New England's best-known haunted locations, according to the announcement. The exhibit promises to offer a blend of history and the paranormal, with stories behind the objects sure to capture visitors' curiosity, according to the announcement. This story was created by Kimberly Green, K. Green, at usatodayco.com, with the assistance of artificial intelligence, AI. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Learn more at cm.usatoday.com/ethical-conduct. PJ's Slush Stop brings allergy-friendly treats to Winchingdon. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. PJ's Slush Stop in Winchingdon is not just a place where you can grab a sweet treat during the summer, but also a place where you can learn a little Winchingdon town history. Tucked away in the historic Isaac Morse House at 135 Front Street in Winchingdon is the cozy one-stop shop for allergy-friendly sweet treats, from Richie's Italian Ice to boba tea and smoothies. PJ's Slush Stop is open Wednesdays to Saturdays from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. Amy Boschko, owner of the Slush Stop, said this is the shop's fourth season open in its permanent storefront location at the Isaac Morse House, and she is grateful for the opportunity provided by the Winchingdon Historical Society. This location used to be an ice cream shop that the Winchingdon Historical Society ran a few years ago, but it closed, and then I got the opportunity to fill it with my business about 4 years ago, she said. There's a lot of history here, from the countertop to the photos on the wall. The Slush Stop is filled with Winchingdon town history. Right when you enter PJ's, on the right is a wall of photos of the Joseph family, and in the center is a photo of Catherine Drudy, or as locals know her, Seppi, during the 100-year anniversary of the store in 2010. The countertop that Boschko is currently using is the original countertop from the old Joseph store on Central Street. The Joseph store building was demolished in 2017, so the current Cumberland Farms gas station could be built. Before Joseph's was demolished, the Winchingdon Historical Society scooped up the counter and restored it so they could use it in their ice cream shop. She said, that scuff mark is where Seppi, the last owner of the shop, would make kids count out their money to buy candy and other sweet treats. A lot of people come in and feel like one of those kids. Bringing allergen-friendly sweets to the greater Gardner area. Like many, Boschko decided to move her family out west during the COVID-19 pandemic, looking for a larger home with more space at a lower price. But when it came time to plan her son PJ's birthday, she noticed there was no place to grab Richie's Italian Ice in the area, which is her family's favorite treat. Richie's Italian Ice, based in Everett, is peanut, tree nut, dairy, and gluten-free, and it comes in over 30 flavors. While it's not ice cream, Boschko said, it has the consistency of hard scoop ice cream, and you do have to scoop it to serve it. We don't really have Italian ice around here. It's only really ice cream, and that can be a problem for some families who have to watch out for allergens, she said. We love Richie's and have been eating it ourselves for years, and we just think it's such an amazingly delicious product without the fear of being exposed to those allergens. All menu items at PJ's Slush Stop are allergen-friendly, from slush toppings to all beverages like the boba milk tea. The boba tea is served with non-dairy milk, such as oat milk or soy milk. Boschko said she wanted to give families with severe food allergies a place where they can still grab a sweet treat without worrying. PJ's Slush Stop is only open during the summer. Boschko said she plans to close for the season after Labor Day when school starts. She said during the off-season, she has pop-up events at the Sunshine Cafe in the Winchingdon CAC. I only open seasonally, but during the fall and winter, I do pop-up events at the CAC. Last year, I had a boba milk tea bar during one of their community events, she said. The Winchingdon CAC has been an amazing supporter as well. Driver charged with motor vehicle homicide in death of Oakmont student. This is by Rachel Gao with the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. In Leominster, months after a car plunged from a highway overpass in Leominster, killing a senior at Oakmont Regional High School, the driver of the vehicle was arraigned Monday, July 27th, on motor vehicle homicide charges. Brian Ramirez Nunez, 18, faces charges of motor vehicle homicide, negligent operation of a motor vehicle, marked lanes violation, and speeding in the death of his former classmate, 18-year-old Travis Texera. Donning a white quarter-zip sweatshirt and khakis, Nunez appeared steely-eyed as he pleaded not guilty to all charges in Leominster District Court. He was led away in handcuffs after his bail was set at $1,000 cash for the homicide charge and $500 for the other counts. The courtroom was overflowing with friends and family of Texera, who was set to graduate high school just months after the fatal March 20th crash. He was taken by Life Flight from the scene of the crash and later pronounced dead. April Quirk, Texera's mother, told the Telegram and Gazette that she would like to see Nunez held accountable for her son's death. He was the driver. My son was just the passenger. He did not deserve what happened to him, she said. You didn't kill your enemy. You didn't kill a stranger. You killed someone that called you a friend. Nunez has been ordered not to have contact with Texera's family and to surrender his driver's license and passport during the course of the proceedings. His lawyer, Philip J. Doherty, did not immediately respond to requests for comment, though in arguing for a reduced bail, he said Nunez, of Westminster, had no prior criminal record and had been cooperative with police. Texera, of Ashburnham, died hours after a pickup truck Nunez was driving on Route 2 East went off an overpass and landed on Nashua Street below on the night of March 20th. Texera had been in the passenger seat. Nunez allegedly swerved aggressively before ending up in the median of the roadway and traveling for a significant distance. The car then went airborne after hitting an embankment, according to court records. According to court documents, Nunez had been driving erratically, with multiple witnesses alleging he was speeding and attempting to pass or cut off other drivers. Police later determined the car to be traveling nearly 85 miles per hour in an area with a speed limit of 55 miles per hour, according to court documents. A third passenger, who had been in the back seat of the car, told police that Nunez's driving speed had made him nervous. Nunez told police following the crash that he had been attempting to change lanes to make room for a merging vehicle, but was unable to do so due to a car in the left lane. He was forced to swerve back into the right lane and later lost control of the car. Following an investigation, Nunez was charged with 3 counts related to reckless driving June 22nd. A vehicular homicide charge was added July 24th. Choking back tears, Quirk described a life that has been torn apart after her son's death. Going home and seeing his empty bedroom and waiting for him to come home has just been a nightmare, she told the Telegram and Gazette. It just really changed every part of our lives and took all the happiness out of our life. It will never be the same again for us. Quirk said she would like to receive an apology at minimum and felt it important for Nunez to face jail time. I'm facing a life sentence. My 5 other children, we're all doing life sentences. Travis, he's never coming back, she said. Would new bill help Massachusetts housing crisis? Automatic two-family zoning. This is by Margie Cullen with the USA Today Network, New England. The Massachusetts Senate, July 23rd, passed a measure it hopes will create unprecedented levels of new housing in Massachusetts. The legislation, included in the Senate's sweeping economic development bill, would apply automatic two-family zoning across Massachusetts, allowing duplexes to be built on most residential properties. Senate President Karen Spilka, Democrat from Ashland, said in a statement that the measure will provide opportunities for new families to find a home they can afford. Senator Michael Rodriguez, Democrat for Westport, said it will spur housing development. Housing advocates say this measure could help tackle the state's housing crisis. Under current zoning laws, only 1/3 of the state's land allows duplexes by right. Abundant Housing Massachusetts said in a press release, "This simple solution could unlock thousands of new homes to address our housing affordability crisis." As the Senate's economic development bill is different from the House's, the two chambers must come to an agreement in conference committees before it goes to Governor Maura T. Healey's desk. How does the bill make two-family zoning automatic? The bill would effectively end single-family zoning by allowing duplexes to be built in most residential zones. No zoning ordinance or bylaw shall prohibit, unreasonably restrict, or require a special permit or other discretionary zoning approval for the use of land or structures for a single duplex on lots zoned for residential use, the bill reads. There are some restrictions. Municipalities can set standards for height and design, and properties that need septic systems can be exempt, but standards cannot be unreasonably restrictive. A local regulation, ordinance, or bylaw shall not be more restrictive of duplexes than of single-family dwellings, and shall not, individually or cumulatively, render the development of a duplex physically or financially infeasible, the bill says. Regulations are only allowed if they address a specific, articulable concern that cannot be addressed by less restrictive means. Massachusetts housing crisis. Massachusetts is in a housing crisis, according to the state government's website, with some of the highest home prices in the country. A June poll from the University of New Hampshire Survey Center found a majority of Massachusetts residents believe housing, or the cost of living, is the most important problem facing the state. A July poll from the same center found that one-third of residents said they are likely to leave the state within the next 5 years, largely because of the cost of housing and living. On top of other statewide efforts, including a ballot question that aims to make more affordable starter homes, the bill takes other steps to combat the problem. It also authorizes $2.5 million for a pilot program that helps construct permanently affordable homeownership units, or units for low and moderate income households. And now, over to you, Risa.
Thank you, Alexandra. And we'll begin this segment of this evening's program with a story about an upcoming vote that has quite an impact. It's by Amelia Cardona of the Gardner News. Voter registration for Narragansett Joint Town Meeting closed on July 24th. Phillipston and Templeton will hold a district-wide special town meeting to vote on the Narragansett Regional School District fiscal 2027 budget on Monday, August 3rd. Even though voter registration is already closed, the vote itself is still in the future. So here are important things to know. The joint meeting is necessary after Phillipston failed to approve an override to cover its share of the regional school district budget. Templeton voters approved the school budget at their annual town meeting on May 13th, but both towns must agree on the budget for it to take effect. Phillipston voters have voted down the school budget twice, first at the annual town meeting on May 6th and again at the ballot box on June 30th, when town officials asked voters for $208,000 for the school budget. The second vote passed at a special town meeting on June 10th, but narrowly failed at the ballot vote that also had to pass to fund the budget, since the additional funds will be a Proposition 2.5 override. What is on the joint meeting warrant? The one article warrant is asking voters to approve $26,978,139 for the fiscal 2027 NRSD budget. The $26.9 million budget is the same figure that Phillipston voters turned down in June. The meeting will be held at the Narragansett Regional Middle School in the Safka Auditorium at 460 Baldwinville Road in Baldwinville, and will start at 6 p.m. Joshua Smith has been selected by the Narragansett School Committee to serve as moderator for the district-wide meeting. Smith is the Barrytown moderator. The last day to register for vote in the district-wide meeting was Friday, July 24th. Residents could also have registered to vote online at the Secretary of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts website. What will happen if the budget fails? If the $26.9 million budget does not pass at the Monday, August 3rd meeting, district-wide meeting, the school committee will discuss next steps to resolve the budget's disagreement. The committee will have to recertify a fiscal year 27 school budget before they can discuss whether they want to plan another district-wide meeting to present the budget yet again to both town voters in the hope that it will be passed. The school district has already cut 13 staff positions. If the fiscal year 27, $26.9 million budget is not passed, the school committee could consider laying off additional teachers and cutting programs, including athletics and the Thrive special education program. As of July 1st, until a budget is passed, the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is involved and will set a monthly spending limit, which is typically called a 1/12 budget. On July 15th, Governor Maura Healey announced $100 million in supplemental school funding at an average of $112 per student. Allocations to individual districts have not yet been announced, but with just over 1,400 students at Narragansett District, they would receive $161,000 if it is paid at the average rate. What will happen if the budget passes? If the FY27 budget passes at the August 3rd meeting, then Phillipston officials will need to either hold a special town meeting with a ballot vote for another override vote, or decide to cut the additional school budget funds from the town portion of the budget. Can the budget be amended on town meeting floor? Yeah. Voters can make a motion during a district-wide meeting to make an amendment to the budget. How will voters check in? Chrissy Haslett, Phillipston interim town clerk, said that when the voters arrive at the Narragansett Regional School Building, they will enter and check in through separate doors, depending on their town of residence. How will the vote be tallied? Haslett said voters will use automated clickers to record the vote of the district-wide meeting. When was the last time a joint town meeting happened? The last time Templeton and Phillipston participated in a district-wide meeting was during the COVID-19 pandemic in September 2020, when both towns' voters gathered outside at the Narragansett Regional Middle/High School game field behind the school. Smith was also the moderator at the 2020 district-wide meeting. The 2020 district-wide meeting was called to approve a 2021 fiscal year school budget. Our next story looks back at a very important day in both Gardner and Red Sox history. It's by Jay Guerin of the Gardner News. Red Sox Streak revives story of Ted Williams and Gardner Day at Fenway. On the lower level of the Baseball Hall of Fame, over an archway in the records room, hangs the world's largest baseball bat. Its journey to Cooperstown, New York, actually began in Gardner 35 years ago on the day highlighted in the pages of Life magazine. The 12-foot relic called the, quote, Ted Williams Special, quote, was only one of numerous gifts presented to the Red Sox on August 25, 1946, Gardner Day at Fenway Park. Over 2,000 Gardnerites gathered to cheer on the pennant-bound Bo Sox as they played the Cleveland Indians in a Sunday doubleheader. Area manufacturers donated rockers, Morris chairs, tricycles, doll carriages, and baby carriages to the members of the Red Sox and their families at between-game ceremonies. In order to emphasize their presence, the organizers also brought the 13-foot, 750-pound chair from Union Square as a monumental symbol of the Chair City. Indeed, Gardner was represented in a big way with the world's biggest bat and chair on the same stage. Bill McMahon, former city councilor and service manager at Haywood Wakefield Company, was the prime mover and general chairman of the project. Now retired and living in Batavia, New York, McMahon remembers the planning and the day quite well. It was a promotional idea, really. I sat down with Carl Lugbauer and asked him if he would like to see Ted Williams sitting in the big Haywood chair on the cover of Life magazine. Lugbauer, who was the advertising manager at Haywood's, loved the idea and worked with designer Joe Carr in sketching out a dummy copy of Life to be sent to the nationally circulated magazine, complete with details of the whole day. The idea was approved by Life, and although it didn't make the cover, The event was pictured along with a story in a 3-page spread of the September 1946 issue. In preparation for the major event, designer Carr went to work on construction of a bat suitable for the Star Slugger Williams. At first, we made a 6-footer, but in front of 33,000 people, we thought it just wouldn't stand out, Carr recalled. So Carr obtained a telephone pole, and the Anderson Wood Turning Company shaped it into proportion. In volume, I guess it was 8 times bigger, he said. The late Dick Wells, another Haywood employee and local umpire, constructed a huge baseball to go with the bat, and Gardner was ready for, quote, pilgrimage to Fenway, as the Gardner News called the 1946 trip. On the Sunday morning of the doubleheader, 32 buses lined up at the corner of Pine and Central Streets, several with banners proclaiming local factory names. The total cost of the day, bus and game ticket, was $3.30. Oh, for the old days. After the Red Sox took the first game 2-1, Bobby Doerr's 2 homers did it. It was time for the Gardner presentation. McMahon tells a couple of problems that were quickly overcome by the persistence of the Gardner contingent. The public relations people at Fenway told us to make our presentation about 10 feet from the gate in right field, McMahon said. I knew we had to get Ted up on that chair, so when those gates opened, we marched right down to home plate. Then the various gifts were lined up along the first and third baselines, and Gardnerites poured onto the field. Never one to showboat, Williams at first absolutely refused McMahon's offer to sit atop the Haywood chair. Get Doerr up there, Williams snarled at McMahon. Some fast thinking did the trick. Ted was lured out of the dugout to see the enormous bat, and the fans began to chant their wishes for Williams to climb aboard the giant chair. As the cheers grew louder, there was nothing else Ted could do. So, with a lift from the masked Governor Maurice Tobin, I knew he'd come, it was an election year, joked McMahon, the big outfielder perched on top, and the famous photograph was snapped. The photo is also at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Gardner Mayor Oscar Anderholm threw out the first ball for the second game, and the Red Sox went on to sweep the Indians that day. The Gardner fans went home happy, and the Red Sox that season were to go on to capture their first pennant since 1918. Maybe things were simpler then. Baseball certainly was. Player strikes and split seasons were unheard of, and the teams with the best records in each division met each other for the championship. So here's a simple solution to the Red Sox problem of the 1980s. Let's get Captain Carl Yastrzemski up in the Gardner chair in 1982 and watch the Sox climb into the World Series again. Editor's note, this story was initially published by the Gardner News on October 10, 1981, recalling the magical 1946 season for the Red Sox that included the Red Sox last 15-game winning streak. In light of the 2026 Red Sox 15-game winning streak, we are republishing it here for you. Now, staying with the baseball theme, we'll look at a current-day Quabbin team. This story is by Kate Kemp of the Gardner News. Quabbin Little League makes history with first sectional appearance. Barry. For the first time, Quabbin 1-2-U Little League is District 3 representative in the Massachusetts sectional tournament. Though their spot was due to a lack of opponents in District 3, they showed their skill as they put up a fight in Section 1 first round against District 4 winner Holden on July 22nd. Quabbin, the host of the first round game, faltered in the first inning, giving up 4 runs. The rest of the game more accurately reflected the kind of team they are, despite the 6-0 loss. Ace pitcher Richie Valcourt pitched a complete game, only allowing two more runs after Holden's initial push. "I try to lock in for the game," Falcourt said. "Obviously, this is a very good hitting team. I've been preparing for a little bit for this game, and I was just trying to jam them high and inside, and it worked out." The sectional bracket for Section 1 is a double elimination, so Quabbin isn't done yet. They played District 2 winner Westfield the following day and had to win that game to stay alive in the tournament. Holden will face the other Round 1 winner, District 1's Pittsfield. We don't have information on how that came out, but I'm sure we'll hear about it later. This group of kids were committed. We've been committed for the last couple of years to try to build to this point, Quabbin head coach Matt LaPointe said. To get to the sectionals and host a sectional game for the first time ever, and to come out and put a showing on like that, we're super proud of the kids. The team showed strong moments throughout the game, like Valcourt's pitching and a string of big hits in the bottom of the fourth that just couldn't quite lead to a run. Lucas Valcourt smacked a base hit through the infield to start things off in the fourth, and Dylan Mace and Murphy LaPointe both earned hits as well. Though runners were left on base and Holden got out of the inning unscathed, Quabbin showed its grit despite the early setbacks. "We held our ground and we did a good job, and that gives us confidence for tomorrow," Mace said. Coach LaPointe added, "We never got down, even though we just couldn't get that big hit." Quabbin will continue to represent the Gardner area as they attempt to stay alive in the journey to the Little League World Series. That completes this segment of this evening's program, and I'll be back later with the final segment. But for now, Alexandra has more Gardner news for you, so take it away, Alexandra.
Thank you, Risa. Weekend escapes near Gardner range from ghosts to coasters. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. Before backpacks are packed and school bells ring, families in the Gardner area still have time to squeeze in one last summer getaway, with destinations ranging from historic inns and mountain adventures to nearby attractions perfect for a weekend escape. As summer winds down and the first day of school approaches, families still have time for one more getaway. From historic overnight stays and cozy bed and breakfasts near Gardner to mountain adventures in the Berkshires, there are plenty of family-friendly destinations within a few hours' drive that can make for a memorable end-of-summer escape. There is no need to drive hours away from Gardner area to make a memorable day trip for the whole family. There are several options within Greater Gardner, but if you want a change of scenery, there are some unique options about a two-hour drive that make great weekend trips. Near Greater Gardner. If your family is filled with history buffs or ghost hunters, then no need to look any further. Right in Winchingdon is the historic Isaac Morse House, owned by the Winchingdon History and Cultural Center, where people can stay for $395 a night. The antique home is also the Toy Town Museum, filled with Winchingdon's history. You can book a stay at the Isaac Morse House through Airbnb. Just a 30-minute drive from the Gardner area is the Revival Wheeler Mansion in Orange. They have six different types of rooms and suites that range from $258 to $600 for two nights. People can book a stay at the Wheel Mansion through Airbnb, and the minimum stay is two nights. While you're in downtown Orange, visit Billy Goat Boats, where you can rent canoes, kayaks, paddleboards, and paddle boats, and then explore the Millers River. Haworth House in Fitchburg is a local bed and breakfast about 30 minutes from Gardner, a place to unplug not too far from home. Amenities include a swimming pool, hot tub, and outdoor setting with a fire pit. Rooms range from $215 to $255 per night. Getaways and day trips less than 2 hours from Greater Gardner. Get away to the Vacation Village in the Berkshires in Hancock, a 2-hour drive from Gardner. A room at the Vacation Village ranges from $132 to $169 per night. The mountain resort has a swimming pool and an arcade game room. If you're looking for activities for the whole family, visit Jimmy Peak Mountain Adventure Park. The adventure park has an alpine slide, a mountain coaster, mountain biking, rock climbing wall, and a giant swing. Tickets range from $54 to $64. In Amherst, there's the Stone House Farm Bed and Breakfast that is about a 50-minute drive from Gardner. Rooms range from $250 to $500 a night. There's a two-night minimum. Amherst is surrounded by natural attractions, from Mountain Sugarloaf for hiking and sightseeing to the Smith College Botanic Gardens and art museums. Other kid-friendly sites in the Amherst area include the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art in Amherst and the Amazing World of Dr. Seuss Museum in Springfield. Barry Land's $500,000 state grant for locally owned dirt road upgrades. This is by Craig S. Semin with the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. In Barry, all existing dirt roads in Barry will be seeing improvements over the next year, with smoother rides made possible by a grant from the State Department of Transportation. The town has been awarded $500,000 from the department's Unpaved Roads Program. The funding was announced Tuesday, July 21st. Launched in 2025, the program supports the maintenance and improvement of locally owned dirt and gravel roads across Massachusetts. Department of Public Works Superintendent Timothy Batchelor gave a breakdown of the town's road projects. Batchelor said paving is slated to start on Williamsville Road from Valley Road to Farrington Road and Lower Fruitland Road by the end of August. In addition, Town Farm Road from South Barry Road to the Old Dump Road will be full depth reclaimed, graded, and injected with calcium to stabilize the roadbed, according to Batchelor. Town Farm Road will not be paved until stormwater drainage is completed in the spring of 2027. It will remain a gravel road over the winter, Batchelor said. The town is also evaluating Dana, Old Dana, Cutler, and Old Hardwick Roads, prioritizing their conditions so the town can continue paving as funds become available. Batchelor said the Unpaved Roads Program is huge for the town of Barry. Large amounts of gravel have been needed for years, but due to cost of materials, the town has been unable to do what was needed to maintain them properly, he said. Barry depends 100% for road paving and repair with funds from MassDOT Chapter 90 program. There is not a specific line item in the DPW budget to pave roads with town funds. Without the state roads funding, Batchelor said Barry would be in even worse shape than it is now. All the MassDOT personnel we work with on projects are excellent and want the towns to succeed in road repair, Batchelor continued. The condition of our dirt roads is poor because most roadbeds have minimal gravel, making grading very difficult due to protruding ledge and large rocks. Governor Maura T. Healey also spoke the praises of Unpaved Roads Program. Every community deserves safe, reliable roads that people can count on to get to work, school, and home, Healey said. These grants will help cities and towns make important improvements to local roads that residents, businesses, and emergency responders use every day. We're proud to partner with municipalities across Massachusetts to make these investments that strengthen infrastructure, improve safety, and support local communities. Barry's funding is part of $11.26 million distributed in the program, with 48 communities receiving funds. Mass residents have lost $7 million to crypto ATM scams. Bill would ban them. This is by Margie Cullen with the USA Today Network, New England. In 2022, a Maynard woman almost lost $10,000 to Bitcoin scammers through a crypto ATM. In 2025, police saved a woman from losing $20,000 in another Bitcoin ATM scam in Lakeville. In these cases, the victims had been contacted by scammers posing as authority figures who invented emergencies and told them to immediately send money through a crypto ATM. But once the money is transferred in one of these machines, the chances of getting it back are near zero. In the past 5 years, these scams have skyrocketed. According to a press release from the office of Senator John Cronin, Democrat for Fitchburg, in the last year alone, Massachusetts residents have lost nearly $7 million to crypto ATM scams, according to AARP. Some seniors have lost their entire life savings. Now, lawmakers are trying to prevent future victims by cracking down on the machines themselves. Early on July 24th, the Mass Senate passed legislation to ban crypto ATM kiosks in Massachusetts as part of its economic development bill. I was proud to pass the amendment that bans crypto ATM kiosks, but more importantly, that saves people in the Commonwealth from future predatory scams, Cronin, who filed the amendment, said in a statement. This amendment is a strong consumer protection measure that recognizes the unique dangers posed by these machines. It recognizes that regulation is not enough when the risk is the machine itself. And it recognizes that the Commonwealth has a responsibility to act before more residents lose their savings, their homes, and their financial security. Bill seeks to ban crypto ATMs. The amendment bans virtual currency kiosks from operating in Massachusetts. Virtual currency kiosks, or crypto ATMs, are physical kiosks that convert cash into cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. While they look like traditional ATMs and are similarly often located in convenience stores, they do not connect to a bank account and instead link directly to a digital wallet to transfer digital assets, according to Cronin's office. The amendment gives the Attorney General the authority to bring a civil action against anyone who operates a crypto ATM in the state. What's next? The crypto ATM ban was not included in the House's version of the Economic Development Bill, so the two chambers will have to come to an agreement in conference committees before it can go to Governor Maura Healey's desk. Four states, including Vermont, have already passed bans on crypto ATMs, as have a few towns in Massachusetts. Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell issued a statement supporting the legislation, saying it will strengthen consumer safeguards and protect residents from harm. Campbell has already worked to crack down on crypto ATMs in the state. In February, her office sued cryptocurrency kiosk operator Bitcoin Depot for facilitating scams, causing them to close all their locations in Massachusetts. I'm now going to read an excerpt from the following article. Trump imposes new tariffs. How will it affect prices in Massachusetts? This is by Margie Cullen with the USA Today Network, New England. President Donald Trump's new sweeping set of tariffs could affect businesses and the price of goods in Massachusetts. On July 20th, he set a new 50% tariff on a wide range of imports from Canada, and on July 24th, he imposed 10 to 12.5% tariffs on imports from 60 trading partners. The tariffs affect products from wine to clothing, but many products, including energy and a broad range of food items, are exempt, meaning the impact on Americans' wallets will be limited. Governor Maura Healey slammed the tariffs, saying they have increased costs for every Massachusetts business and resident. She encouraged businesses in the state to apply for refunds. The people of Massachusetts have faced more expensive groceries, household goods, construction materials, and more because of these tariffs, Healey continued in a statement. The Trump administration must also issue refunds to American households, and the president needs to actually focus on making life more affordable and abandon his costly tariff plans for good. What do the new 10% tariffs affect? The new 10 to 12.5% tariffs are replacing the global 10% import tax Trump imposed in February after the Supreme Court struck down the tariffs he had levied in 2025. The new tariffs took effect just as the old ones expired. The tariffs are nearly universal, but there are many exemptions, including oil and gas, fertilizer, and a broad range of imported food products, including many types of meats, nuts, seasonal fruits, and spices. Many tech products are exempt, as is some medical equipment. Consumers are likely to feel the greatest impact from the tariffs on clothing and other textiles, James Cox, managing partner for Harris Financial Group, told USA Today. However, since the tariffs are simply replacing expired ones, any new consequences from the tariffs may be minimal, economists told USA Today. In fact, with more exemptions and a lower overall tariff rate, the new tariffs could cost American consumers a bit less than the old ones. And now, back over to you, Risa.
Thank you again, Alexandra. And we'll begin this final segment of this evening's program with the results of one of the Gardner News Athletes of the Year competitions. It's by Kate Kemp of the Gardner News. And the Gardner News is often referred to in this piece as TGN, the Gardner News. Okay. The Gardner News gave readers a chance to vote to help decide the winner of the Boys Track and Field Athlete of the Year. After a long, hard-fought spring season, three Gardner area athletes and two relay teams proved their impact and were nominated for the honor. Readers' votes make up 25% of the tally, with staff votes making up the rest of the vote. After combining the two methods, the results are now in. Here are the Gardner News Boys Track and Field Athlete of the Year and honorable mentions. TGN Boys Track and Field Athlete of the Year. The winner of the Boys Track and Field Athlete of the Year is Oakmont's Sprint Medley team of Tegan Yoder, Jackson Deloge, Jackson Traylor, and Jaden Brostrom. The athletes were not only successful as individuals throughout the season, but joined forces to take their talent to the national level and placed eighth in the country at the Nike Nationals in the 1600 Sprint Medley Relay. Yoder, Deloge, Traylor, and Bronston were named All-Americans for the outstanding performance at Nationals. Honorable mentions. Earning second place is Gardner's 4x800 relay team. Bradley Batez, Noah O'Toole, Sakari Jenkins, and Paul Foley. The group finished in the top 10 at Division 6 state championship meet. Their performance was record-breaking for the Wildcats, topping a record that stood since 2010. The top scorer in the readers' poll and third place overall is Narragansett's Jordan Bowman. He was a D6 state champion in the 110 hurdles and also competed in the same event at the Meet of Champions. Final tallies. TGN staff votes, Oakmont Relay Team 9, Gardner Relay Team 6, Bowman 3. Readers' poll, Bowman 3, Gardner Relay Team 2, and Aurora Akoma Mensa 1. He's from Quabbin. Totals, Oakmont Relay Team 9, Gardner Relay Team 8, Bowman 6, and Akoma Mensa 1. So congratulations to all these good athletes for the work they did. Next, we look at questions that will appear on November's statewide ballot. 9 questions qualify for the Massachusetts ballot. See the description and the order. It's by Margie Cullen of the USA Today Network, New England. Massachusetts voters will see 9 questions on their ballot this November, the Secretary of the Commonwealth, William Galvin's office, announced on July 21st. The list was official Tuesday, July 21st, after a challenge to a question to repeal legal marijuana sales failed. Other questions include ones to allow same-day voter registration, to expand the state's public record law and to establish all-party primaries. Here's what to know. Questions to appear on the 2026 ballot. First Deputy Secretary Michelle Tesinari, Director of the Elections Division, assigned the order of the ballot questions according to Galvin's office, which said in a press release, the questions were ordered, quote, in a manner intended to maximize space on the ballot, with the length of the question summaries being a primary consideration. With so many questions, ballots in most communities are expected to be 2 or 3 pages long, the press release continued. The length of each community's ballot will depend on the number of offices and candidates running in that community, whether the ballot must be printed in more than one language, and any local questions that may be added to the ballot by the city or town. Here's the order of the questions and a brief summary. Question 1. Expanding the public records law. This proposal, backed by the Massachusetts auditor, Diana DiSoglio, would make most records held by the governor's office and legislature subject to the state's public records law. Question 2. Collective bargaining for CPCS employees. This proposal would allow employees of the Committee for Public Counsel Services to form a union. Question 3. State primary elections. This proposal would make Massachusetts state elections starting in 2028 like Boston's. Candidates of all parties would be on a single ballot in the primary, with the two top finishers advancing to the general elections. These are sometimes known as jungle primaries. Question 4. Election day registration. This question, proposed by Galvin, would allow Massachusetts voters to register at the polls on Election Day, also known as same-day voter registration. Question 5. State revenue limit and rebate. Business groups are pushing this question that would make the state revenue surplus cap law account for money from the millionaire's surtax. Question 6. Natural Resources Conservation Fund. This proposed law would establish a Nature for All fund that would receive 50% of state taxes from sporting goods, recreational vehicles, and golf courses. The money would be used for natural resource conservation, such as protecting green spaces and bodies of water. Question 7. Single-family homes. Pushed as an initiative to make more affordable starter homes, this law would allow single-family homes to be built on lots as small as 5,000 square feet, provided they have at least a little room between the road. Question 8. Prohibit retail sale of adult recreational use marijuana. While Massachusetts has increasingly legalized marijuana in recent years, this question would repeal provisions in the current law that allow for the drug to be sold commercially in the state. Question 9. Firearms regulations. This is a referendum question on the 2024 gun law reform, known as Chapter 135, that strengthened Massachusetts gun regulations. A yes vote would uphold the law, and a no vote would repeal it. Our next story looks at things that are being considered to keep the fun going now the World Cup is over. It's by Margie Cullen of the USA Today Network, New England. World Cup is over, but Massachusetts senators want to keep the fun going. Last call has been at 3 a.m. in Massachusetts during the 2026 FIFA World Cup, leading to long nights of partying with the Tartan Army. But the provision is set to expire July 31st and return Massachusetts' last call time to 2 a.m., unless a group of senators get their way. Senators Julian Sear, Democrat of Provincetown, Robin Kennedy, Democrat of Worcester, and Pavel Payano, Democrat of Lawrence, have filed a slate of amendments to the Senate's economic development bill that would boost nightlife in the state, including permanently extending last call and public drinking districts, as well as allowing happy hour. I've already been asked so many times how we can keep the fun rolling, and there's one answer that's simple: by finally bringing back happy hour in Massachusetts. Sear, who was one of the sponsors of the latest last call proposal, said in his July newsletter, "For decades, we've been one of the only states in the country without it, and this month has shown just how much energy, community, and economic activity comes from giving people more ways to gather." What is the fun agenda? Here are some of the amendments lawmakers are proposing that have to do with nightlife and entertainment in Massachusetts. First, allowing happy hour, or a time when drinks are discounted. Next, extending last call to 3 a.m. permanently. Then, extending public drinking districts permanently. Allowing certain establishments to start selling alcohol at 8 a.m. instead of 10 a.m. on Sundays. Creating a microgrant program for those engaged in public arts, performance, and cultural and community programming that, quote, activates downtowns. And finally, capping concert sale resale prices and banning speculative tickets. Will 3 a.m. last call be permanent? Governor Maura T. Healey has suggested she's in favor of extending last call permanently. She said to Politico that she was, quote, certainly open, unquote, to it. And her press secretary, Jacqueline Manning, said in late June that she, quote, welcomed additional conversations on the subject. In an interview on WEEI July 17th, she said she wants an extension of later last call. However, there's still a long road ahead. All of the amendments must be approved by the Senate and then the House before going to Healey's desk to be signed into law. It's unclear if all that will happen before the July 31st deadline hits. Now, some other ways to keep the fun going. This is a staff report from the Gardner News. Mass Trails Grant to fund Winchendon Rail Trail Upgrades. Winchendon residents can look forward to a more accessible and welcoming rail trail thanks to a $16,000 Mass Trails grant from the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation, according to a community announcement. The grant will combine with a $4,000 contribution from the Winchendon Redevelopment Authority and will fund a series of upgrades aimed at enhancing the trail's accessibility and user experience. Planned improvements include a new benches, to replace damaged infrastructure and provide additional resting areas, waste and recycling stations to help keep the trail clean, pet waste stations for trail users, and picnic tables where residents and visitors can gather to enjoy the trail. Project part of ongoing effort to improve rail trail. The project is part of the town's ongoing effort to maintain and improve the rail trail as a recreational resource for people of all ages, abilities, and abilities, according to the announcement. Town officials thank the Economic Development Task Force, Planning Coordinator Nicole Roberts, DPW Director Patrick Wood, and the Winchendon Redevelopment Authority for helping move the project forward. And that completes this evening's program. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Risa Sachs, reading This Evening with Alexandra Zapantis. Thank you for listening.